This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 38. And we're just going to get right into it because the band is back together. We have the therapist roundtable in the house, so I'm very excited that we have a chance to get everybody back together. The last couple roundtables we've done have been quite popular, and continue to be popular and have legs. So it's great to bring everybody back again. We even got listener questions this time, which is pretty exciting that we get to tackle. And so for those that haven't listened to a therapist roundtable yet, I'm going to have you all, Lauren, Veronica, and Bryson, introduce yourself and tell a little bit about who you are and where you're at, and then we'll get rolling. So who wants to start? Lauren.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to start then. So my name is Lauren Foster, or I guess Dr. Lauren Foster now. So I am a recent graduate of Loma Linda University in the Marriage and Family Therapy program. I am a little bit sort of outside of the normal MFT track. So I am currently working at the Housing Authority of the County of San Bernardino. So it was a little relationship cultivated through the PhD process I have. So working with them now.
Great. Veronica.
I'm Dr. Veronica Kuhn, and I am an assistant professor at Texas Women's University out in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And I have been here, I'm starting my second year, so relatively junior in my faculty appointment. But I teach internship and supervision classes, so internship to master's level clinicians and supervisor training to doc level students. And then I also have a private practice at the Couple Zone in Frisco, Texas, where I see right now only couples, which is very exciting, on part of my week. Yeah.
Great. And Bryson.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Bryson Greaves. I'm also a recent graduate of Loma Linda. I had the privilege of graduating in Dr. Foster's cohort, so we're getting used to these new titles, I suppose. But yeah. So I am in private practice. I in a couple of different capacities. I'm in a group private practice in Carlsbad, California, and then I have an individual private practice in La Jolla, California, and I do some adjunct teaching for various universities in the county and actually abroad on the East Coast. So I am fortunate enough to have my hands in a couple of different areas. So.
Great. Okay, so I thought in this roundtable we're going to cover a couple of topics, and social media being one, self-care, which is always a popular topic, being another. But before we do that, we received a couple of questions from listener Tessa Gordon in Los Angeles, awesome therapist in Los Angeles, and she really gave us some great stuff to kind of jump off on, and some stuff that I think we're all interested in. And it's this idea of, she's interested in maybe having us tackle the process of looking for private practice internships, just kind of that thing. How do you transitioning from, you know, being in grad school as a trainee and then stepping into being an MFT intern, soon to be associate, and all the challenges therein, which, you know, can be how do you find a private practice internship? What's made you successful in that process? And then I'll get to some other questions, but maybe would somebody be interested in maybe tackling how that starts?
It's a great question. Thank you, Tessa. I'll start. Actually entered for my internship. I went directly into a private practice and worked as an intern in private practice. I think in a lot of ways, to be quite honest, I didn't know what I was getting myself into and learned along the way. And I've been in private practice for 5 or 6 years after that. So there are certainly things I learned that if I could pass along, I think would be people would find helpful. I think on the first kind of idea for any student who's looking for an intern position would be to consider the pace at which you're hoping to get your hours and the flexibility with which you're hoping your schedule has. Private practice is sort of a double-edged sword, I think, for interns, at least in my experience. On the one hand, there can be a lot of flexibility and flexibility with your schedule, various things like that. On the downside, you tend to get your hours quite a bit slower than you would at an agency or a hospital, particularly if, you know, a lot of these internships, people are able to find them at like partial residential programs or full residential programs, and so they're going to get their hours a lot quicker, you know, maybe 18 months, 2 years versus 3 years if you're trying to do private practice as an intern.
Right.
I think beyond that too, being able to, as an intern, when you go into a private practice interview, I think some of the most important things to ask of that private practice clinician who's going to provide you supervision is, from a business point of view, how are they getting their referrals and how would they be distributed to you as the intern? Because some people, I think, are really kind of go-getters, and they're happy to go market and they're happy to put themselves out there and sort of rub elbows with people in the community and get a good referral network. But it does take time to build a reputation in a community. I think most private practice clinicians experience that at about 6 or 9 months it's going to take to build up a private practice. That was my experience. So if you have a private practice that you're considering, my recommendation would be to really ask direct questions of that private practice about how they are marketing and how they're going to get clients to you as the clinician, as well as what their expectations are for you to do your own marketing and get your own referral network.
Great. Anybody else?
I think this is a really interesting question. Having done all my training in California and then moved to Texas, most of the people that I know in California went into some sort of agency work and not necessarily right into private practice. But I think context is really important because out here in Texas, an LMFT associate is what they're called out here, which is, I think, what California is moving to, which is that intern level, can start a private practice on their own without being in someone else's practice. So we have a lot of students who come into our program already knowing that they want to go into private practice. And being here in Texas, where we have a lot of resource deserts, I think is the term that they use. In some ways, it's kind of concerning to me, the number of people who want to go into private practice, because it means we don't have a lot of people going into agency work to serve those like low income or marginalized populations with systemic care. So I think I'm always trying to encourage my students to consider a combination of like private practice and some sort of other placement, because I think working with marginalized or at-risk populations brings a depth to the practice that I'm not sure is always captured in just a private practice alone. And I think also it can attend to some of what Bryson was talking about in terms of developing a community network, developing a presence within the community that can sort of serve two things: enhancing your skill set while also, you know, growing your private practice and contributing to the community that you live in by serving some underserved populations.
Great. Yeah. Okay.
Chris, sorry, yeah. Maybe I'll add one other thing. Because oftentimes, at least in California, I think Veronica raises a really good point about the differences across states. So speaking on for California and the way we do things over here, I think when people want to go into private practice as an intern or associate level clinician, the supervision and the type of supervision and the therapists who is the supervisor or presumably the practice owner, that person's commitment to the supervision, I think are really important things to consider in the private practice sector, which I think can tend to be a lot different than private or, a community-based setting or a hospital-based setting where somebody is essentially being paid to do supervision, and that's a part of their job description. A private practice owner is working as a supervisor, and there's a lot of benefits to that, but at the same time, that is time out of their schedule from seeing clients. So being able to get a supervisor who has a strong commitment to providing supervision and can provide the associate clinician support, both self of the therapist, self-care, some of the topics we've touched on, but also case management and clinical case supervision, I think are really key components for anybody considering an internship to ask of the potential hire.
Yeah. And I guess I'm wondering what had you thinking about, because Tessa asked about, whether it be, she's asking about population, field orientation, these kinds of things. What kind of drove you? Because I know Lauren's in doing something a little bit different, but you both are now and have been in private practice. But what drove or what kind of was your primary interest in finding a private practice supervisor or internship, et cetera?
For me, there was a couple. One, probably the key component for me, even just reflecting back on it, was at the time I was starting my doctoral work, and I knew I was going to be in courses at least 2 days a week, if not three, and that was a hard thing for me. My choice was either being a per diem clinician at an agency or find a way to compete with other really strong applicants who weren't maybe going to be in the doctoral program so that they could commit 4 to 5 days a week as an intern, whereas I might only be able to commit 2 to 3. So the flexibility in private practice was something that definitely was on my mind, and I was concerned I wouldn't have been able to do that in the same way in an agency or hospital setting or community-based clinic. And then second to that was I had an opportunity to work with a supervisor who was trained in a model that I found to be really helpful and that I wanted to continue to build in my emotionally focused couple therapy work, with a strong practice already in place that would allow me to see couples, which is really something that I'm passionate about. So those things came together, and I just was fortunate enough to land in a place that could have me.
Yeah, I think both of my private practice experiences have been post-licensure, so once I was fully licensed. But the thing that moved me to want to be in private practice was to free myself of some of the limitations that come with working with clients who are on Medicaid or Medi-Cal in terms of diagnosis and treatment limitations. So the agencies that I worked at, we were required to diagnose. In some cases, I was at clinics who had pretty limited resources, and that meant that we could only see those who had pretty severe psychopathology. And in some ways, I don't know that I necessarily got to develop my use of theory in the same way as working with clients who come in private practice, because the severity of symptoms meant that we were doing a lot of crisis management. And so theory application looked different in those settings. Also because of the agencies that I was working at, there were sort of set forth theories that would be used, like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavior therapy. So moving into private practice, I was able to move into using theories that I was sort of developing and strengthening throughout my doc program that I wanted to apply in my clinical practice in sort of a different and meaningful way without the confines of insurance panels.
Right. Lauren, do you have any interest in, after this experience of moving into the private practice world or seeking that out? Or
I think it's an interesting idea. But I think, so my thought the whole time while you all were discussing it was like, well, my area of interest and like my population of interest are typically going to be like lower income families. Mm. So I would love to, but it's a matter of how are these people going to, you know, afford to pay and afford to pay themselves, right? Like without me necessarily being a part of an insurance panel or something like that, how would folks be able to do that? Or like thinking about things like, would I want to develop a private practice and have it be close to like a bus line or something like that? So people that, you know, I would want to work with and that, you know, that I'm passionate about working with have the opportunity and like just the practical means of getting there every time. So I think that's where I love the idea. And I think I like the idea of like trying to do both hands, like maybe working in a more public setting and then having some clients that are, you know, going to be able to pay, you know, and to afford to do that themselves, to be able to strengthen aspects of different aspects of my therapeutic practice. But yeah, that's where I'm like, oh, okay, this sounds great. But I know that this is like, these are the folks that I really want to work with. And just logically, like, are they going to be able to afford what it is that I would need to be able to sustain a private practice in and of itself without sort of undercutting what it is that I need to, you know, at the very least, you know, make ends meet there. So,
which is a great segue into the kind of the next topic, because Tessa also had some concerns about finances, like, and how do you do these things if you don't have certain financial means? How do you make a livable income? And she's kind of located in Southern California, which can be, you know, challenging. So what are the creative options for earning hours and earning a livable income in Southern California? Where I'm located in Orange County, oftentimes interns aren't even paid because there's such competition, right? I think, Lauren, you're out in San Bernardino, Riverside County, where it's a little better, but there's still situations, I think, right, where interns aren't paid. But I think that's a great question. It's a challenging question. How do you, because I hear the same things. I think there, I meet with a lot of trainees. I meet with a lot of students that have certain aspirations, but there's some financial realities that are you know, in the way. So do you guys have any thoughts about that or any advice?
I want to acknowledge, at least from my experience, it seemed like it was students who had maybe more financial privilege were the ones who chose to go into private practice as interns. And I think that probably was a huge barrier for me for even considering that as an option, that it was sort of, I knew that I needed to make a steady and stable and reliable income upon graduation. And so moving into an agency where there was a salary seemed like the only way to do that. And that's not to say it is the only way to do that. I think some of us have talked about doing sort of a combination of both private practice and agency work. And in some ways, working part-time at an agency, you can actually make more because they don't have to pay you benefits. So I worked part-time as at an agency in my master's program as a case manager and made more hourly than when I graduated and was working full-time as an intern because the pay was higher because they didn't have to offer benefits, meaning I did not have health benefits, which is another issue for some people, depending on your age and socioeconomic status and access to those sorts of things. But I think that being said, I think there are opportunities right now for people to get really creative in terms of doing other things to bring in income that are still related to mental health or relational support or relational health, like couples support groups or
weekend intensive groups that can bring in income in a different kind of way. Also thinking about doing group models of care can also be a way to bring in more income, which I think is where it gets uncomfortable for a lot of therapists to start talking about, like, how do I serve clients and still make a lot of money or make enough money to live on? I think that's the part that, at least for me, where I feel uncomfortable sometimes talking. Similar to Lauren, I've always wanted to work with marginalized populations. So there then becomes this double bind of, how do I work with these populations who can't afford private practice while also not cutting off my income or devaluing my worth to provide care? It's this really uncomfortable bind that I think almost oftentimes feels uncomfortable to talk about, or like it's not allowed to be talked about and doesn't get acknowledged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I can certainly relate to that, Veronica. And I've talked to therapists who've been in the field, lot longer than me at this point. And one of the ways that I have heard people deal with this, and one of the ways I've tried to deal with that tension between sort of the heartfelt giving aspect of what I want to be as a therapist, as well as the how do I pay my bills and make this a sustainable career if this is what I'm passionate about. One of those balances is to hold a portion of your workload, a portion of your practice. I have fairly strong feelings about pro bono work, just because I think from a clinical perspective, I think you can run into some problems with doing pro bono work, not to mention ethical issues, depending on the context, certainly. But I think finding ways to use your clinical skill or your therapeutic passion in ways that maybe don't have somebody paying full fee, or finding an organization in which you could, do work a couple times a year or once a month, or over the weekends, I think are ways for me that I have found to satisfy a portion of what I sort of feel drawn to, as well as have a sustainable practice. So I volunteer my time. I don't get paid, but I have done things like stand down through the Veterans Association, working with veterans. They do a weekend a couple times a year, and I have tried to go and be a clinical provider or at least a group facilitator during those. So I think there's resources out there, and certainly there are nonprofits out there who could use our services where they're either, minimally paid for or not paid for. And I think it can balance that part of the tension.
Can I ask you a question about that, Bryson? And I imagine our listeners might, what is your concern ethically about the pro bono work? Because I think I might disagree with that line of reasoning, but I was wondering what your thought is.
Yeah, I did clarify the context. Sure, I think that there are contexts in which pro bono work works. I think as a private practice clinician, offering your services for free in your office,
got it,
I think you can run into ethical issues. Being able to be a pro bono therapist during times of tragedy, we just experienced one not too long ago, and I know both in Northern California with the fires that are going on, as well as Las Vegas, there's a lot of calls for therapists to go out and do pro bono work. That is a context in which I think it's terrific. And needed, frankly, and we should all try and strive to do that when we can. The part of doing that in private practice and feeling compelled to offer your services for free when you're in private practice, I think you can run into some dilemmas with that.
Well, I was thinking about my own experience and what you were talking about. I had a sense that I wanted to do private practice. So immediately getting my intern number, I found a private practice supervisor who I wanted to, she had never taken on an intern before, but I talked her into it. And because of a particular model, orientation, narrative therapy, and I just thought I could learn a lot, and did. But what I did also learn is that I found private practice to be kind of isolating, right? And so, mm-hmm. And then that moved me back into this kind of aspiration I always had about creating community, and which led to starting a nonprofit community counseling practice, California Family Institute, which I think kind of brought the both those worlds together in some way, kind of similar to what Lauren was talking about. And we don't take insurance, but nobody's turned away no matter what they can afford. Mm-hmm. So, and it's set up really like a private practice. I think the clinicians there enjoy it because it is kind of set up like a private practice, but they're also working with marginalized populations and doing a lot of interesting work. And we're not bogged down with a particular evidence-based practice we have to use, or they're actually getting to learn to be clinicians rather than administrators of paperwork, which has been very fortunate. Mm-hmm. But I guess the also point I want to make is, in all transparency, I didn't have the financial pressures that most of my colleagues did. You know, I those that don't know, I had a business. I came from the corporate world. I had a business that was a successful business, and I sold it, and I went back to grad school, and it allowed me a lot of freedom to do some things, and so I can't claim that I've experienced the same challenges that others have, but I do have some ideas. I like Veronica's idea about the creativity. There's still creative ways to, and this is something I'm really interested in because I've done a couple workshops now on MFT and the entrepreneurship in the MFT. Mm-hmm. I just did one at the MFT Leadership Symposium earlier this year in Alexandria, Virginia. And it was kind of introducing some ideas to therapists that other than private practice, they could do some of these things, and they could do corporate consulting. They could do these groups. And Lauren, you're basically kind of doing corporate consulting in some ways, right? At the public level, right? And I'm thinking, corporate consulting, just corporate wellness. I know it gets some critique, but that's still out there. You could do workshops of all various kinds. There's lots of people on the internet that you can create your own webinars and learn. There's a lot of, and I know there's traditionalists that would say, well, no, we just do therapy in our little rooms, right? And I think, one of the questions I think Tessa was talking about is how do we take these outside? How do we take this work outside of the four walls, right? And I think there's something I'm very interested in. How do we do that? And Lauren, maybe the question is to you. How have you liked the experience of kind of acting as a consultant in some ways, right?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So it's been interesting because obviously I did my master's program, took about a year off, and then I did my doc program. So I've been sort of entrenched and always surrounded in the world of, marriage and family therapy, and that's who I'm friends with. Like those are like this is my home. Those are my people. And so during my doctoral process, partnered and had a lot of relationship with our county's housing authority. So slowly but surely starting to step outside of the MFT world and seeing what, other people's perspectives are, which was great. And then through that, I've been able to go through a number of conferences and things like that and interact with folks who are in like public policy, who are in urban development, planning, architecture, things like that. So it's been interesting because I appreciate the traditionalists who feel like, therapy is what we do and that's all sort of what we do. But there is so much and so much that we can offer so many different fields. And being, like you said, Chris, being creative about that is huge because something like okay, the idea of resilience, fairly simple, something that we all sort of get, whether you sort of buy into it or not is something very different, but it's something that as therapists we all get and generally sort of hold on to. But resilience isn't an idea that people really consider outside of mental health. And so just presenting something like that to folks who are in public policy is like mind blowing to them. And that's something that is, I think, one of those sort of taken for granted experiences and ideas that we have. Whereas in other fields, it's like, oh, this is transformational. This is amazing. What do you think about this? And so I think it really and truly allows us opportunity and space to not only market ourselves and what we want to do and further some of our own ideas, but it allows us to further the field in general. So that now I am doing some consulting with the Housing Authority. So I have a full-time position with them, looking over their policies and, you know, seeing what works and what doesn't. And they're very, because of the relationship, obviously, they're very open to me saying, like, hey, this thing here that's affecting thousands and thousands of families in your county on an everyday basis, this particular policy isn't working. Can we do something like X? And because I'm there and because my background is obviously in marriage and family therapy, I can suggest things like, you know, maybe adding in social services, maybe bringing in more mental health, doing things like that. That are very much informed by my, you know, MFT background that otherwise they wouldn't consider, honestly. And they really take into account a number of things. So it's been very interesting seeing that and sort of seeing how the world outside of MFT land operates. But I think it ultimately gives me the opportunity to advocate for the families that I'm really passionate about working with. So I appreciate the purist and it works. But on some level, if you're doing consultation, you're kind of doing family therapy. It's at a slightly bigger scale, but you're definitely working with systems regardless. And you're trying to get them to work better and together and whatever better means, right? But it's definitely interesting work for sure.
Right. Any other ideas?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that as I've moved along in my career, I think I've become somewhat of a critic of like therapists as I become become more of a therapist, because I think we do get too confined by four walls and we forget about, at least for the four of us, and probably, I don't know about Trish, was that her name? The person who wrote in? I don't know what her training was. Tessa, sorry. I don't know what Tessa's training was, if she's a family therapist, but I like our foundation is systems, right? And working with systems and working with a couple or a family is great, but there are so many other systems that need shifting. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is we are talking about mental health awareness with other mental health professionals, which just seems sort of odd. And we should be doing things more like what Lauren is talking about, reaching sort of across the aisle or outside of the four walls to different areas. So I've been partnering with a hospital in the area with a specialty physician, not a mental health physician, talking about how are we integrating social support into that department that they're working in. Similar to what Lauren's doing, reading these sort of laws and policies that impact families, that impact systems, but that don't have systemic or family language in it. I think another way that's really useful for us to bring in income is to be able to write. People are constantly looking for people to write or author white pages or different writing projects outside of mental health fields that then get ideas and constructs about mental health and wellness or just systemic or relational justice issues outside of just those who are providing or consuming mental health services. Right. And I think that's where there's going to be a larger social change and can also be a way to bring in income in addition to private practice work.
A great idea. I didn't even think about it. I just wrote a white paper for an organization and it paid really well. It did. Mm-hmm. And so
I will also say, just in case people, like in case the monetary piece
you know, it sort of drives us to some level. Yeah. Consultations pay a decent price. I mean, you can't obviously go in the first time and ask for $1 million. That's ridiculous. But consulting or even joining a consultation firm, because there are, especially if you're on the East Coast where they have tons of consultation firms, sure, they're oftentimes looking for people who are well-versed in social sciences. And so you could even join, you know, consultation firm, and they pay very well, and they will pay a lot of money for your particular knowledge. Also, sort of going back to what Veronica was saying, a lot of our MFT models were founded with folks who were or in doing practice outside of the four walls of therapy. So even if you think of something like structural family therapy, it was founded with like very, very low income families in mind. And if you go to places like Philadelphia, like New Jersey, that's still done outside of the confines of the traditional therapy office. Like that's typically, or for a lot of folks, it's done inside of people's homes. Mm-hmm. So that is so far outside of, you know, what traditional quote-unquote therapy is thought of being, and that's like one little step outside of, you know, the traditional confines of what therapy is, but it makes a huge impact. So even doing something like that, or going to an agency where they advocate doing in-home family therapy, which is a whole other sort of genre, or it comes with its own risks and benefits, but even doing something like that sort of steps outside of the walls of therapy, brings you into people's everyday lives in terms of being in their home, and people act, the dynamics are very different there. But even something as simple as like, instead of, you know, doing that, maybe being able to go into people's homes or doing therapy in their communities. And so I did that for about a year, and you definitely get a different dynamic and a different feel of, you know, who the family is, what's sort of happening in that particular dynamic as well.
That's great. And I'm glad we're talking about money, because I don't think it gets talked about a lot, mm-hmm. honestly, you yeah. know? And so, and I know, you know, this being the radical therapist, there's people that are quite critical of probably listening in of capitalism and those kinds of things. And, you know, that's great, but I guess I'm interested in disruption, right? Yeah, we're under those lines of forces, right? Our lines of force, and how do we disrupt it? And one of the ways I think we're talking about now is, how do we disrupt this model, a therapy model, so that we can, so that other, like the concerns of Tessa, like how do I make a living? How do I do this thing I really want to do and make a living? How do I, these things seem unavailable to me because of financial concerns. And so how do we get creative? How do we become disruptive? Right. And I think that's a really important question. Sometimes it is kind of, you know, stepping behind enemy lines into the system a bit but disrupting it and changing it and making it look different and doing creative things. And that's really interesting to me. Any thoughts?
I was just thinking of the irony of family therapists having like no secrets policy, and then yet thinking about all the secrets that are embedded in our field about like right. not talking about like financial sustainability, or not talking about moving outside the four walls, right? The people that I know who are doing therapy in sort of these different ways that are not in traditional therapy rooms, or with maybe more quote unquote traditional therapy systems like couples or families, oftentimes don't want to talk about it because they don't want to get in trouble, or there's a fear that, like, I don't know, there's a lot of secrets, yeah. Which I think is just kind of ironic.
Mm. Yeah, all of this, and certainly Lauren, your experience and what you just shared, I think got me thinking about this. But, you know, do we call it disruption? Do we call it collaboration? I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that we could consider doing what I feel like is probably an expansion of the field. And in a lot of ways, I think, to get at your question, Chris, one of the ways as therapists we think about doing that is at like the highest level of abstraction. We live within a pretty bureaucratic system. It's a capitalistic system. And there's some limitations to how therapists get paid that aren't usually by the choice of the therapist, but can also be a higher systemic bureaucracy that we try and work within, as well as within our legal and ethical you know, guidelines. And I think in a lot of ways it comes down to the stigma of mental health and in the and to the stigma of getting supportive services for various things that people are experiencing, mental, emotional, relational health. I think in a lot, if we just think about insurance companies in a lot of ways, it's only been fairly recent that they have even had considerable well-paying reimbursement for mental health services or relational or emotional health services. I mean, that's a fairly recent thing. And I think in a lot of ways what we're challenged with, or maybe what we're charged with as family therapists who want to be able to make this field sustainable, is to try and expand the field, like in the ways Lauren and Veronica are talking about, in terms of recognition of the field at different levels of a system, as well as destigmatizing what it means to go see a therapist. Because I think in a lot of ways, both at the financial side of things as well as just the stigmatization side of things, there's limits on who is coming into therapy. And if we want to make our field both impactful and helpful and transformative, I think it's addressing those things head on that we're going to find the most movement.
Right. So before we move on to the next topic, Tess had a question about how to develop these business skills that MSTs don't learn in grad school. I mean, it's pretty clear that we're not taught, and this is, you know, fortunately for me, I came from the business world, and so I didn't, but I noticed the people around me didn't, and they were struggling, or there was some hesitation and doubt and all those kinds of struggles, and I'm wondering, what do you think, or what do you think would be helpful, or how do you do it, or are you still trying to do it?
I became friends with Chris and Bryson, and I call them all the time. I think at least weekly I call you guys, because I am new at this private practice stuff, and we don't learn this. I mean, I think I went back to my like master's curriculum and was like, did I miss that day in class? Like, I think the part that I was most surprised that I knew nothing about, which I shouldn't be so surprised about, was taxes and setting up my business, not just paying the taxes, but setting up my business appropriately, my private practice business appropriately, so that my taxes were clear and filing the forms. And I've called the IRS several times now and waited on hold for an hour and still not talked to anyone. Yeah. So, and as a woman, there's also this part of me that's like, I want to be able to do these things on my own. Like, I don't want to have to farm out, once again, thinking about income. Like, I don't want to have to pay a bunch of people to run my business for me. There's also some, like confidentiality things around that. But these are things that I want to know and understand for myself, and we're not learning them, which is really concerning. And I think a critique of the education that we're receiving, I think there's also probably some liability if schools started teaching it right. If a graduate then has some like IRS fraud or something, and they go back and they said, this is what I learned in school. But even just where to get the information about how to navigate these other systems, other government systems, I think is really complicated. So, I mean, if you all have any advice, I'm going to be taking notes over here, because I could use all the resources.
Boy, I don't know that I have advice. I'm still learning along the way, and it's been fun, to be quite honest. There are some distinctions that I think we should maybe clarify, or at least as I'm hearing us talk about it, that we should make between an associate level or an intern level clinician and a licensed clinician, because I think the needs of those two areas are different. I mean, one of the benefits to being an associate level clinician in private practice is you can learn experientially about what it means to run a private practice, hold a private practice caseload, manage a caseload, all of the things that go into being in a private practice without the financial overhead and the liability, the sole liability of doing it on your own versus you know, coming into a private practice later in your career, and you're sort of established in other forms of the work, but then you're trying to learn the business aspect, and you have to take on, you know, liability of having an office lease that you have to pay for, and some of these other things. I think by the same token, one of the issues, and probably I would imagine not sitting in a faculty position in a master's program, is one, there's so much to learn about being a therapist to begin with. The business aspect, I would imagine, is the first thing to go on a lot of those curriculums, because for multiple reasons, one being there's just going to be time in somebody's career to learn those aspects later on. And second, a lot of our nonprofits, a lot of our agencies, a lot of the things that allow populations that don't get service from the mental health field, in order for them to get service, a lot of that runs on intern positions. And I think if we were to start losing a lot of interns and associate clinicians into the private practice realm, I think it could hurt the nonprofit realm. And a lot of these agencies that really depend on good, sound clinical labor from very, very good candidates in the internship realm. So those are just some thoughts there.
Well, and I think in Orange County with, what is it, probably 10 plus MFT programs, I don't think they're going to run out of.
Yeah, it's true.
I think the problem is people finding sites now. And I think oftentimes it is a matter of, like, how do we get creative? And sometimes they're forced into creativity, right?
Mm-hmm. One other thing on the private practice. So if I separated the conversation, I'm sorry, but around the interns versus licensed, for the folks more in the licensed track or looking to get licensed soon, a clinician by the name of Lynn Grodzki, it's Grodzki, has written a couple of really helpful books. One is called 12 Months to Your Ideal Private Practice. The other is Building Your Ideal Private Practice, which is sort of the second edition that came out to her first edition. It was really helpful to me in terms of the business aspects of being a private practice clinician, how to set up different forms, how to do marketing, how to track marketing. I think knowing where your referrals come from is probably more important than just having referrals. Being able to track where they are so that you can put resources into the things that actually sort of communicate back to you as the clinician, where are the people that are interested in my services coming from? What is that population? Who are they? How do they know about me? Because if you just do the shotgun approach and you just sort of fire out your resources in marketing out there into cyberspace, and you don't track where they're coming from, it can be really hard to know if you're getting the most bang for your buck. There's a lot of options when it comes to marketing, and the Lynn Grodzki books really do help sort of narrow that focus and has a lot of things that were helpful for me to consider. So
here's the $100 question. To niche or not to niche?
I don't. That might be more than a $100 question.
Yeah, it is a practice question. I know the conventional wisdom says do the niche. What do you think?
I think I'm just going to, I'll just go with a gut reaction. I think there's something to be said for being at a very high level of competence in a particular area, whether that's model, whether that's population, whether that's subject or diagnosis, or however you view that. I think there is something to be said for being known for something that you do. I would say both for self-care of the therapist as well as marketing, don't let that be the only thing you do. Expand your horizons some. Now that's just a personal gut reaction, not formulated in any sort of business sense.
I like it. I like it. Anybody else?
I don't know if I would say like yes or no. I would say more about like intentionality, which is more about like thinking about the practice that you want to have or the work that you want to do and building it for that. So maybe it's not a niche theoretical orientation or a niche population or clinical issue, but it's more of like when I think about, when I look back in 20 years on the practice that I've done, what sort of impact do I want to make in this community where I'm setting up my practice? I think is more of what I think about, because I do see my work a lot as giving back to the community, not just the individual clients or the system clients that I work with. So I think it's more about like that intentionality of what you want your work to mean and be about, that I think can then inform like if you need to have a niche or not.
For me, there's something like organic that has to come out of it, right? Like, so at some level, maybe a niche develops, but it does so organically. So like if I was thinking like, okay, I want to sort of develop a private practice, at this point, I know like that's just like, this is sort of the area that I'm like really drawn to. And it's been literally over the course of my life, like this is sort of the area that I'm really drawn to. These are the folks that I just seem to work really well with. And so I would wonder if some of it, the intentionality comes afterwards, after you have this like, oh, wait, I think I'm like really good at this thing. I think I'm like really, really interested in this area over the course of time. So I will wonder if it's got to be a mix of a number of different things.
Mm-hmm. Like it.
I think too, sorry, just one more thing I was thinking is about what people want from their, if we're thinking about the initial question around being an intern at that intern level, what you want your internship experience to look like. Do you want it to be diverse and working with different populations and trying out different theoretical orientations? And in that case, maybe having a niche wouldn't be a good fit, versus do you want to become an expert in couples therapy using X theory? Then having a niche would be really important to really grow that skill as an intern. So I think it also depends on like what your intention mm-hmm. is for that intern period, about what your learning goals are, which I don't think we talk very much about mm-hmm. at that intern level. We talk about getting hours, but we don't talk about like our learning outcomes during that period. What are we setting out to learn during that time? Because I think people have learning goals during that time. They just don't talk about it. They talk about getting the hours done.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. That's great. Okay, so let's move a little bit into self-care and social media, but we'll start with self-care and we'll stick with Tessa's questions. She had questions about where to turn for support through the beginning stages of your career, and what do you do when perfection or imposter syndrome shows up? So a couple of big questions, but what do you think?
I have a great friend who quotes Marge Simpson and says, you just have to stay one lesson ahead of the students. I guess Marge Simpson becomes a piano teacher to bring in extra money, and she doesn't know how to play piano. And she says, you just have to stay one lesson ahead of the student. So that's in regards to the imposter syndrome or feeling like a fraud. Like, as long as you're one step ahead or one lesson ahead, I think you're okay. I always fall back on like fake it till you make it. And also transparency, right? I think if we all don't acknowledge that fraud, then it just becomes this even bigger expectation. Mm-hmm. And I frequently feel like a fraud, and I disclose that with my supervisees, and I sit a lot in the not knowing, and I've gotten actually really comfortable with that. And that feels more comfortable than trying to sit in the expert and mm-hmm. feeling the fraud. I don't know if that makes sense.
Totally. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, well, we've spoken about it, and I think in some ways this is what we do as our therapist roundtable here, right? We have developed a consultation group of sorts. I mean, certainly when we're not just on our podcast here, the four of us talk frequently. And we consult. I think ethically we should be consulting, particularly when we're not sure of our own therapeutic reaction to something or whether or not we handled something the way that we thought we might do that, or whether or not we have legal questions, ethical questions. We should be in the practice of consulting. At least that's my belief. So I think establishing that early on as a consultation group or people who think differently than you or work in different settings than you, or not just get sort of located within your strong community of everybody has the same viewpoint of what to do, but expanding that to include people who think differently or see things differently or have different experiences, I think can be really, really valuable. I also, when it comes to imposter syndrome, certainly validating that as something I think we all go through, I will at least be accountable to myself with that. It's something that I feel frequently, and there's good weeks and bad weeks. But I think one of the things that has really helped me over the years here, I have thought to myself, confidence does not equal competence. Those are two different constructs. Competence is experience mixed with sort of passion and trying stuff. Confidence, I think, is a willingness to fail. It's a willingness, it's an active willingness to try to expand your level of comfort and do things that you don't really feel you could do. And when you do that, I think we can experience confidence, or I think we hold confidence. But I think oftentimes, at least for me early on, confidence felt like I would know exactly what to do in every clinical situation, or I'd be the best EFT therapist, or, you know, or the best internal family systems therapist. And that's a different construct than competence, or confidence. Right. Yeah. So I don't think that confidence equals competence.
So the whole time we were talking, I was sort of thinking about our writing group. So we have a wonderful writing group that Veronica started last year. And it is the four of us, as well as two, maybe three of our other colleagues. It was initially like, hey, we're here. We've all got things that we need to be writing. We've all got things that we need to be doing. And who better to hold you accountable than the people that sort of understand your deadlines and what you actually need to be doing versus, you know, some other people who may not get it quite as much. Mm. And I saw over the course of time the writing group morph into like, hey, let's do some check-ins. Let's see where you're at with your writing. And also, how is life going? Like, what else is happening that is probably going to impact your ability to write, your ability to like be able to focus? Mm-hmm. And so I know for me, I really enjoy that experience because the writing group started at the very beginning of me like getting my dissertation proposal done. It went through my entire actual dissertation writing process. And so it was an incredible time for me to be able to like just say to a group of people, like, you know, this wasn't a good week, and to be very honest about it. And I'm just naturally the sort of person, I kind of keep things to myself, and to have a group of people that I know would be supportive of me regardless of, you know, my own perceptions of how people perceive me. It was nice. It was a really helpful experience. And I think it really helped with, especially at the end of my dissertation process, feeling like, somebody is going to find out that I have like messed something up along the way. Like, I know I did. Like, there's no reason why I'm going to get this degree at the end of all of this. So I think really being honest and having a group of supportive people has been really helpful for me in dealing with some aspects of imposter syndrome. And I think it sort of morphs and changes over time. I think that at some moments it feels like, you know, I'm being an imposter in this way, or somebody's going to find out this thing about me, or I'm not as capable as I truly am. But I don't know. I feel like if you have a group of supportive people, for me, I guess it's that community and being able to sort of, you know, talk back to that whatever part of myself that's, you know, telling me that I'm not, you know, worthy or I'm not competent, capable, what have you. And it also ended up rolling into my self-care. So it became a very integral part of my self-care routine to be able to talk to folks for, and it was like an hour every week. I was able to sort of debrief and tell people what was going on and to move on through my day, but it was really helpful. And especially at a time that was extremely stressful for me, being able to have that and just to have a sounding board of folks who I knew were going to be supportive one way or another was really helpful for me. So, yeah, I don't know if that fully answered the question.
No, that was great. You had me thinking about, hey, first listeners, you know, go find you a group of people like Lauren, Veronica, and Bryson and make them meet with you regularly on Skype or whatever it's got to be. And because I was thinking of self-care, and I don't think there's anything I like better than getting together and talking about the work. I really like Bryson's idea about, because I mean, we all come from really different places, right? And kind of, and we locate ourselves theoretically in different places and the models in different places. And I think that's real. I really appreciate that about us coming together. I do. So I think there's nothing greater. I agree, Lauren, like with the self of having a community to come together and mm-hmm. have conversations. I mean, sure, a massage every once in a while or mm-hmm. or what have you is great, you know, and you should do all those things. And, you know, and I have a meditation practice, and I would point to that as like necessary. But something about being in community and mm-hmm. sharing experience and asking for help when needed, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things. And being and having a group of people where we can sit with each other and say, I don't know what the heck I'm doing, right? mm-hmm. Please help. And it's just,
yeah.
So I would.
And feeling that.
Yeah, go.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, and feeling that safety to be that vulnerable with a group of people, I think is really necessary. Go ahead, Veronica.
Well, I was just going to say, I actually have found myself reaching out to strangers too. I mean, you guys are all really great, but reaching out to strangers. So I have two young children. I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. And so a lot of times I experience my life and roles that I take on in different ways because I have young children and I have some different challenges. And I've found on Facebook through other parents, a lot of groups in terms of like academic mom Facebook groups where I can ask questions about promotion and tenure or publishing or research. I also have found Moms in Private Practice, which is a group of moms who are in private practice across the nation who talk about what does it mean to have these the different balances and challenges. So I think Bryson started off by saying private practice has some flexibility, but then it also has some ways that it's not so flexible. And that's one of the things that I think I've really struggled with as a parent, having clients who call me on a weekend in a crisis, and I don't have an office phone. I have just my cell phone. And so how do I navigate that? And what does that look like? And what boundaries do I want to set with my clients? And then what boundaries are ethical given like my ethical guidelines that I have to follow, right? Attending to clients when they're in crisis, but also not giving away my time with my family or friends or my self-care time. So having some niche groups around some of the areas where I think or I know that I struggle or have some nuanced issues about via Facebook or social media has actually been really supportive to me. And even just reading what other people who maybe are in similar situations as me are going through has also been really helpful to feel validated that like I'm sort of what we were talking about, that imposter syndrome, right? Oh, I'm not an imposter. This is a struggle that other people go through also, right? It's that feeling of when I, you know, go on Facebook and I see someone else is struggling with maintaining boundaries with a client. It's like, oh, I'm not a bad and unethical therapist. And also I need to be talking about this, but like, it happens to other people and it's okay. And like, what can I then do to shift how I'm addressing this or how I'm approaching this issue or concern that I'm having? in a way that doesn't feel so judging, right? Because I know that other people are experiencing it also.
Yeah, there, you reminded me. I think there's two things there, Veronica, that you got me really thinking about. I mean, one is, one of the things, if you're considering private practice, is the hours tend to be a lot different than agency work. I mean, my busiest hours are from about 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the evening. And for some people, that's not going to work for them, for their schedule. And I think that that's, you know, it's much harder to fill a 10 a.m. time slot on a Tuesday than it is to fill a 6 p.m. time slot on a Tuesday. And so certainly there's some variation to that. But for the most part, it's been my experience that your evenings in private practice are really the times in which you're going to work a good amount of your time. And that just doesn't work for everybody. So certainly that, I think, is something to consider. The other thing around just self-care is, I think sometimes we talk about self-care in these blanket terms, but it feels like to me that there's sort of two different avenues of self-care. There's like the thing that we do that really doesn't have anything to do with therapy. It just keeps us rejuvenated and alive and connected, and whether that's a yoga practice, a meditation practice, and it certainly has a benefit to our therapy. And then there is self-care within our practice, consultation, people that we can reach out to have something validated or normalized when we're feeling a particular way. And I think for me, it at least helps to think about both are like really necessary, and they certainly overlap, but having something that can give you a sense of care and compassion and validation and just a way to talk through things about your concerns, about your practice, being a clinician, as well as things that allow you to shut off and really rejuvenate. I think both avenues are important.
That's great. Okay, so you know what? Why don't we end there? And we're going to save social media for when we come back together, and we're going to make it happen sooner this time, right, everybody?
Okay. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. So, and then listeners, if you have things that you want us to chew on, please email me as always at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And the therapist roundtable would be happy to tackle it if we think we can. I don't know. So I want to say thank you to all of you for making the time and coming together again. And hopefully the listeners, you listeners, got some value out of our conversation. And thank you for just giving us the opportunity to come together and have these kinds of conversations. I really appreciate that. Yeah. So, and we appreciate that you listen to it. So until next time, I want to say thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. And
thank you.
We'll do this again soon. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. If you could do me a favor, I'm going to ask for a favor right now. If you're listening via iTunes, or even if you're not, maybe think about going over. It would be really appreciated if you went over to iTunes and rated and reviewed the show. That's how we're going to get out in front of other people, I am told. So please think about doing that if you're listening on iTunes right now, or even if you can. I know a good chunk of you probably are on iTunes. It would be really appreciated if you rated and reviewed the show on iTunes. And as always, if you want stickers, Radical Therapist stickers, just shoot me a line at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We have t-shirts. I actually have some more coming in. So if you'd like a Radical Therapist t-shirt, and if you want to know what they look like, just go on over to the Radical Therapist on Instagram. You can see several pictures of radicals sporting the therapist t-shirt, Radical Therapist t-shirt. And also, you can find us on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, and our website, of course, at theradicaltherapist.com. We're all over social media. Just come find us, engage with us. I love getting emails from you, just getting your thoughts about the show. So, as always, thanks for listening. My name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist. Thank you.